Morning, everyone. Can you hear me? Good. So this week's Parsha, Tetzaveh, talks about the garments of the Kohen Gadol. And I'm just going to read that, but I want to show you first a little bit of a screen share. Let's see if I can get it there. Hold on. Screen share. Hold on 1 second. Just going to see what I'm doing here. Screen share. Let me see. Can people see that? Okay. So what this is a illustration, obviously not a photo. Okay, they had very few photos in those days, so this is a. What the Kohen Gadol's garments are about, which will be talked about in this week's Parsha. That's the various things that I'll be mentioning in a moment. I just want to get into something I want to say. Okay, so did you lose that? Is it still there? Okay, good. So, Parsha Tetzaveh, the word means to command. God tells Moshe to command Moses to receive the children of Israel pure olive oil to feed the everlasting flame of the menorah, which Aaron is to kindle each day from evening until morning. We now have a representation of that in the Ner Tamid, the so-called eternal light in front of the Ark and most synagogues. But it's really not supposed to be on all the time, but people will forget, so they keep it on all the time. But it's really done daily. That's what Ner Tamid means, not eternal, but it means done on a daily basis. The priestly garments to be worn by the Kohanim while serving in the sanctuary are described. All Kohanim wear the ketonet, a full-length linen tunic, michnasayim, linen breeches, mitznefet, or migba'at, a linen turban, and avnet, a large sash wound around the waist. In addition, the Kohen Gadol wore the ephod, an apron-like garment made of blue, purple, and red-dyed wool, linen, and gold thread, the choshen, which is a breastplate upon which 12 precious stones inscribed the names of the 12 tribes of Israel, the me'il, a cloak of blue wool, with gold bells and decorative pomegranates on its hem, and the tzitz, the golden plate worn on the forehead, bearing the inscription, Holy to God. So, Tetzaveh also includes a detailed instruction for the seven-day initiation of Aaron and his sons into the priesthood, and for making the golden altar of incense. Now, traditional commentators see the Kohen Gadol's garments as atoning for sin. In the Talmud, someone has a really wonderful way of understanding this, since there are no more Kohanim who are working in the temple or the Mishkan because it no longer exists. So another important quality that the Talmud tells us of the priestly garments is that their very presence worn by the Kohanim during the temple service serves to atone for the sins of Israel. It is taught that just as the offerings facilitate the atonement for sin, so do the priestly garments. And this is one of the deeper aims, the Talmud tells us, of wearing these garments, for the Kohen to ponder when they are upon him. For his everyday actions in the temple transcend his own personal idiom and take on a more universal theme. He makes atonement and spiritual rectification for all humanity. Thus, this is how they see it, and I think it's really a fascinating thing. The tunic, which we talked about, which covers most of the priest's body, atones for killing. Interesting. We can discuss perhaps why, but that's what this Talmudic sage tells us. The pants atone for sexual transgressions. The turban worn on the head atone for haughtiness. The belt wound around the body and worn over the heart atones for the sins of the heart or improper thoughts, and the breastplate atones for errors in judgment. The ephod atones for idolatry. The robe atones for evil speech, and the high priest's crown atones for arrogance. Interesting ways of seeing this, no longer in the context of the Torah, but seeing there was some moral underpinning to all of this. So, atoning for killing, sexual transgressions, haughtiness, sins of the heart, improper thoughts, judgment, errors in judgment, idolatry, evil speech, and arrogance. And we can see where we fit in. So one of the exercises that you could do is when you're getting dressed, to actually have the intentionality, and we'll talk about intentionality in a moment. The role of the costume in spiritual traditions is everywhere. Monks of both East and West create uniforms for their cohorts, particularly when they're involved in temple work. So here we meet the Kohanim, the servers. That's what the word means. Server, it doesn't mean priest, because I don't know what priest means. So if someone can help me. I think it's an ancient French word or something. I'm not sure where it comes from. But it doesn't really translate correctly. It's the servers. They are not monks. And their role is to ensure the ongoing maintenance of the temple. And the temple is the operating system for the pre-Judaic Israelite entity that keeps on working. So remember, this is not Judaism we're talking about. This is a pre-Judaic cult in the best sense of the word, that operates around a temple, which is the, if you will, the operating system, if you will, of the tribes of Israel. Eventually, the temple was destroyed. The Kohanim drifted from history, but were forever kept alive in our Torah description. Now, keeping order is the most primary and necessary function of a centralized shrine. The Kohanic spirit permeates, if you think about it, the first creation story in Genesis, where order is made out of chaos. Many of the Bible critics talk about the fact that that first chapter was written from a priestly, if you will, a tradition. So the Kohanim are the ones who basically keep the fixed rules of the temple, and that is called Keva, K-E-V-A, Keva. Keva means established, something that is established. And so you could say the Kohanim establish Keva, and our prophets will manifesting the importance of Kavana, K-A-V-A-N-A, which means directed intentionality, which is attached to and is a motivator, if you will, for action. Now, this is particularly challenged during prayer, right? Will words be enough? Or do you need directed intentionality in their recitation? Are prayers needed to have Kavanah? Again, Kavanah is preferable, but here you will find, as in the temple, Keva topples Kavanah in judging, if you will, only performative actions. We don't know what's going on in your head. So what do? We don't try to enter into thought control, but we do judge, if you will, by how you act in the world, because that we can see, we can observe. So Keva beats out Kavanah in our tradition, and we only, if you will, pay attention to what we observe. Now Keva, as I mentioned, comes from the word in Hebrew to affix something or to establish. Now I go back to the computer imagery for a moment, because when my teacher's wonderful imagery. Keva is that when you turn on your computer, you expect it will open the same way, and that its operating system is ready to operate as it did when you bought your computer, what happened yesterday, the day before. You don't want a whimsical computer who only works if it wants to. So booting up a computer whose operating system you can depend on every time you turn your computer on. So was the temple. It was an operating system. It functioned the same way every day, as it did yesterday and as it will tomorrow. And that offers, if you will, grounding, this deep grounding. And what the temple was aside from all kinds of other functions, its basic place was to create a space, a holy space, where one can enter into a relationship with God. And the offerings are the example of our wanting to be and offer something to the host of the house. You know that we do it today on the Friday night, you're going for Shabbos dinner, you bring flowers to the host, or you bring a bottle of wine. And what's the ritual? They receive it, and that allows you into their house, and may you might even share from that bottle of wine, etc. So this idea of offering something in order to create relationship or something closeness is a very common thing. So the garb of the Kohen Gadol, which we described in here, basically the Kohen Gadol becomes the embodiment of the people, of the people. One very little thing that you might notice if you're in a synagogue, that when the Torah is dressed, it's dressed to be like the Kohen Gadol. Many have silver breastplates, which you may have seen. Many have crowns. So it's kind of interesting that the Torah, too, is offering us an opportunity, if you will, to see the embodiment of the temple. So no one receives atonement from the Kohen Gadol. That's not his job to give you atonement. His job is to be in connection with the mystery, if you want to call it, right? And to bring it into the world. One appeals to the mysterious host who dwells among you in the house that you built. And the key for forgiveness is that the Kohen and his clan make sure you're taking the right ritual route to ensure the safety of that holy exchange. Also, the fact that the temple is absolutely going to be the same every day is allowing you a wonderful array of routes, of paths. And they can come from people offering a bull, which is, of course, a grand offering, to a fistful of flour thrown upon the flame. So it was a sliding scale, right? And there were individual offerings for individual desires or needs. For instance, the need for expiation, for forgiveness, or etc. Now, what is effective about this kind of structure is that you leave after this performative act of presenting an offering, right, to the host. You are basically expiated. I mean, you're forgiven. You don't have to carry it around anymore. It's gone. It's gone. Now, you might say that's very good to have something that allows you to feel that it's gone, right? Because a lot of people drag around their stuff for a long, long time, all right? But this says, no, you've done it. You're gone. Move on with your life. No longer do you have to worry about this. So that's a very powerful thing, a very powerful thing. Now, the power of Kavanah, and this is really ties into our practice. The idea of intentionality in Buddhism, I won't get involved in it, it's very complicated, but in Buddhism, intentionality is extremely important. According to Buddhist philosophy, whether an action is good or bad depends on primarily on the intention behind it. Depending on the intention, it will bear karmic fruit in good or bad results and create the habit of doing more good or bad actions in turn. Even if you do not take spiritual vows or spin your prayer wheels, there are still many ways you can reinforce your good intentions. What practices or habits help you spread good intentions throughout the world? Another source tells us that we can take the Buddha's words on wise intention and incorporate them into our daily lives. We can start with the traditional teaching of wise intention as the intentions of renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness. And these three intentions build the foundation of this teaching. And we can investigate these intentions in our own experience and see how it fuels our action and speech. So intentionality in Buddhism is very important, but it has to lead to the same thing that Kavanah wants to lead you to. So Kavanah, direction. What direction do I want to be in? What direction do I want to go towards? How do I infuse my life with that sense of direction, of trying to strive towards something? How do we keep, if you will, feeding ourselves, nourishing ourselves? And I think we are doing that particularly in our practice. We're nourishing our capacity that when we go into the world and get off the bench or the chair, that we can basically understand that I have the capacity, if I choose to, right, to basically direct my intentions towards positive action. Again, people can have intentions that are not necessarily so positive, and that will affect, of course, actions as well. So our practice of sitting is really a great form of kavana, of directed intentionality. And I think what's really wonderful that we are able to do consciously is basically engage that deeper part of ourselves that is looking for a way to express oneself in the world. So in a sense, we are saying that, yes, action does necessarily topple kavana, but you can sort of combine the two and get a little bit more sophisticated about it and says, you have to have kavana. Kavana will not always accompany every action you do, but the action is still important, particularly if it's a positive action. A person comes to me and I said, give me $100 to feed a family in Ethiopia. So I say, Ethiopia, what do I have to do in Ethiopia? They're far away, you know. But they're Jews, they need your help. So I give them the $100, even though I have no kavana necessarily. And the proof of my kavana, if I've had it at all, is that I gave the $100 and performed the action. Because the action ultimately is the goal of this directed intentionality. So the goal of Judaism, perhaps you could say, is to bring holiness, if you will, or intentionality into our own lives. And human effort is always supported by our capacity. The Mishkan, too, tried to bring, if you will, the heavenly world into our daily lives. When one went to the temple or the Mishkan, one was imbued with spirit. And that spirit you should take out of the temple when you leave it. Even what we do at TBZ, with what we call prayer, even that, of course, is something that doesn't, that it would be great to have kavana. It doesn't demand it. Keva will ultimately prevail. So keva and kavana are really two poles, particularly around which Jewish prayer revolves. Now, since each of the two moves in opposite directions often, Rabbi Arnold Wolf tells us, equilibrium can only be maintained if both are of equal force. However, the pole of regularity usually proves to be stronger than the pole of spontaneity. And as a result, there's a perpetual danger of prayer or other actions, mitzvot, to become habit, a mechanical performance, an exercise in repetitiousness. But in our mystical tradition, the Jewish mystics, who devoted much energy to the goal of transforming and directing human consciousness, naturally had much to say about kavana, expanding it from the general idea of concentration and intent into specific meditations, kavanot in plural. Particularly Rabbi Isaac Luria, a great mystic, got involved in these very complicated intentions that one should bring into oneself before one did action. Very complicated, and was reserved pretty much for an elite. The various manifestations of divine energy, or the esoteric meanings of prayer to Torah, kavana is intended not merely to ensure mitzvot are performed with proper intention, but to elevate consciousness itself and achieve connection, or is called in mystical terms, devekut, cleaving with God, and the unity of the divine essence. So this tension of keva and kavana is exhibited mostly within, if you will, our ritual lives. And again, the idea of ritual is present in all of our lives. We have created for ourselves rituals. And those rituals are often observed quite, if you will, strictly. the way one gets up in the morning, when they have the first cup of coffee, when they sit for a while, when they get dressed. It's amazing how we have created rituals which give us grounding, give us a sense that I can go into this new day on a foundation. So Keva offers a great deal for us, the established time. We may call it the establishment, and many of us are anti-establishment, but the establishment offers us opportunities of great grounding. Now, in our practice, what offers us that great grounding is paying attention to our breath, which is ultimately the thing that grounds us the most and which unites us with all living creatures, the breath, taking in and giving out. So we should see that we're lucky, in a sense, that our practice talks about both things, keva and kavana. You should sit, right? And you should concentrate on your breathing and being alive. And then when you leave that sit, as I said earlier, you bring that energy, if you will, whatever you want to call it, into the world. And kavana, which is more spontaneous, is interesting, could be disturbing, to be honest, when we sit. Because that's what brings these new thoughts around, and we're constantly seeing these new thoughts arising. So that wonderful tension between keva and kavana is pretty much what the temple, the Mishkan, which we read about last week, and the clothing, the garments of the priest, which you read about this week, they shall not change. But I want to get back to what I said in the beginning. Look at all the things that the garments try to lead us to. We want to atone. And what does atone mean? It asks forgiveness, but it also means becoming at one. At one. A-T and then O-N-E. Right? How do we become at one? How do we get the disparate parts of ourselves to operate in a reasonable way? So we too, I think, as a people today, have to basically atone for killing. I mean, it's a sort of an essential problem if we see in the world. And sexual transgressions, or if you will, you want to call it coercive sexual relations, or you know, things that are done with cruelty and etc. The turban, haughtiness. Wow, we got a lot of haughtiness running around. Everyone thinks that they indeed know it all. That's why the turban represents that. And then the sins of the heart, the things that we harbor within us that are improper. Anger, jealousy, all of those things. They're improper thoughts because it doesn't really lead us to where we want to go. The breastplate, errors in judgment. And we make errors in judgment, and we have to learn to admit that we make errors in judgment. And idolatry, and the way I define it, as you know, it's a TBZ interpretation, which you might agree or not. Idolatry is worshiping the fragment and not the whole. W-H-O-L-E, not the whole, the fragment. You know, I've often talked about this. I love trees, but I don't worship trees. I love stars, I don't worship stars. I'm a sun guy, I like the sun, but I don't worship it. And this was the contribution of of Avraham Avinu, Abraham our father, was, guess what, there's something beyond all that. Don't get stuck in the fragment, right? Don't get stuck in the fragment. See how it all fits into the larger picture. And then again, the need to atone for evil speech. We're hearing a lot of that today. And finally, what I think is the most apparent is the level of arrogance that people have. Arrogance, particularly in this split, if you will, political environment here and elsewhere. The arrogance that my position is absolutely better than yours, and we have to be careful about it, particularly in political terms. Are everybody who is quote unquote for the former president stupid? That's the way we mostly see it, right? Stupid, and they see us as arrogant, products of an elite society, which puts them down and thinks that they are stupid. So these things really do articulate themselves in the world we are in right now. So keva and kavana, good terms. See if you can apply them in your own life. So I'm going to basically open it up now. I'm going to get rid of the Unless you want to keep looking at that picture, I'll get rid of it. Okay, here we are. So.